Greetings once again. Welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can also support the podcast at my Patreon account, making a small or preferably even large donation on a per episode basis. You can find details of all that via all the Turkey Book Talk pages or my website. Now, let's get on with the show. In this episode, I speak to Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington and the author of a new book, Islamic Exceptionalism: How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World, published by Macmillan. The book argues that Islam is fundamentally different from other religions in how it relates to law, politics, and governance. And this has important social implications, and much of today's instability in the Middle East can be traced back to the unresolved question of how Islam relates to the state. The book comes a couple of years after Shadi Hamid's last title, Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East, and I started by asking him what were the big shifts he wanted to address in his new book.
I think, first of all, I've changed myself as a result of writing this new book. And I have to be honest, I've come to have a darker view of human nature. And I think that's what happens when you spend too much time in the Middle East. But when I started writing the new book, Islamic Exceptionalism, I didn't realize that when the book would come out, that there would be this surge of anti-Muslim bigotry in the U.S. and Europe. So, I mean, one thing that I really want to do here is address this question of how much does religion matter? How much of this has to do with Islam in quotation marks, and how much of it has to do with political or economic factors? And I think that's the question that I've gotten so much from, especially American observers. They want to understand, what is this Islam thing? So this book is an attempt to situate the role of religion when we're trying to understand the rise of ISIS, the region's descent into violence and civil war. So that's a big part of it. And I make an argument which, I have to say, I'm slightly uncomfortable with my own argument, because I realize that, first of all, some people will misinterpret it and some people will abuse it for purposes that I myself am very much against. So I argue that Islam is in fact exceptional. Islam is fundamentally different than other major religions in important ways, primarily in how Islam relates to law, politics, and governance. So what that means in practice is that Islam historically, but also today, plays an outsized role in public life, but also that it appears to be uniquely resistant to secularization. And this secularization has been attempted. There have been many, many attempts to, let's say, neutralize or privatize Islam or make it less relevant in everyday life. And those attempts, by and large, have failed, in some cases failed quite miserably, which I think forces us to reckon with the possibility that we aren't all the same. We don't all necessarily want the same things. And that's where I'm trying to challenge this liberal determinism, which I think is implicit in so many of our ISIS-era conversations about Islam, that all peoples, cultures, and societies follow this linear trajectory towards, you know, reformation, then enlightenment, then secularization, then the end of history of liberal democracy. And, you know, it's so much part of our, you know, speaking as an American now, it's so much part of our American culture to just assume these things, that they're inevitable. But what if they're not? And I think it's hard for people to really take on the prospect that Muslims, and I use that word also with some reticence, because obviously Muslims are a very diverse group, but if we're looking at Muslim majority populations, we can talk about a general unwillingness to push religion to the side. And I think that's something that will really continue for the rest of our lives. And if that's the case, that has major implications for how we understand the future of not just the Middle East, but the future of Muslims in the West, in places like France, for example. So I think the implications are quite considerable.
I think you referenced there a kind of discomfort with the conclusion that you make. And obviously, I suppose what you're referring to there is this danger that that is involved in this idea of exceptionalism, and the idea that it maybe plays into the hands of both the most fundamentalist Islamists and the worst Islamophobes in the West.
Exactly, exactly. In that sense, you know, I sort of had a similar issue with the previous book as well, that I ended up arguing things that I wasn't really comfortable with. But that's also why I think that that's one of the best things about being a researcher and thinking through these ideas, that when you start something, you end up being surprised by your own findings. And that, to me, is part of the process of discovery that's inherent to the kind of work that we do or should do. And I have to be faithful to my findings, and I believe what I've written. I believe it's important, and I hope that in the end it will contribute to a more nuanced approach to talking about these issues. And for me, I also want to challenge the Islamophobic right. So they might say, oh, well, look, here's this Muslim dude who's saying that Islam is fundamentally different. But what I'm saying here is that that isn't necessarily a bad thing. So whenever we hear that Islam is different or that it can't be extricated from politics, we assume that means that Islam is backwards or bad or problematic. And we have to also move beyond this presumption that religion always plays a negative role in politics and that the solution is always to move towards secularism. And that's why I very self-consciously chose the word exceptionalism, because to me that's a word that is, or at least should be, value neutral. Exceptionalism can be good and it can be bad. And I think we can talk also about American exceptionalism, which, depending on who you talk to, can be seen in either a negative or positive light. So I hope that people will resist the temptation to cast judgment and say, well, oh, look, Islam is different. That is definitely a bad thing. It may not be, and I argue that it isn't necessarily.
And you write that, quote, when observers discuss the root causes of Middle Eastern conflict, they often speak of a crisis of governance or legitimacy. And you say that this legitimacy deficit is tied to a continued inability to reckon with Islam's relationship to the state. Could you just explain and open this up a little more?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when we talk about ISIS or the demise of the Arab Spring, we might pick certain dates, 2011, or maybe we go back to the Iraq invasion of 2003. And I think that's a very narrow way of looking at it. It's not as if these problems just came out of nowhere. And that's why I emphasize a date which doesn't get as much attention as it should, which is 1924. And for Turkey watchers, hopefully that date will be familiar, but that's the date of the formal abolition of the last caliphate, the Ottoman Caliphate. And really, ever since 1924, there's been a struggle to establish legitimate order in the Middle East. And one of the main reasons for that is because one key issue has remained unresolved, and that's the question of religion's role in public life. And this is where we've had this ongoing divide between what we might call Islamists and non-Islamists. And those non-Islamists can either be secular, liberal, nationalist, whatever. And they haven't been able to resolve this this fundamental divide. And I use the word fundamental or even foundational because these are not just policy differences. It's not about power. It's not about, you know, when we talk about policy differences in the U.S., we talk about specific universal health care, tax policy, whatever. But these are issues that go to the very founding of the state and the very meaning of the nation state. What is the purpose of the nation state? Should the nation state be ideologically or religiously neutral? should the state be entrusted with a mission of promoting a particular conception of virtue? So I think those are the questions that are really, we don't always talk about them openly, but they're at least implicitly there underneath the surface. And I think with the Arab Spring, these issues that were bubbling under the surface finally had an opportunity to come out, because people were debating these issues openly and publicly for the first time, because you had some measure of freedom and democracy in these countries that were experiencing mass protests. So I think those are the kinds of issues that we're probably going to spend the rest of our lives debating. And that's why I think there's a real urgency to addressing them head on. And that's why I'm sometimes uncomfortable when people feel a need to dismiss religion as a prime mover, that religion is just the product. So religious grievances or religious preferences are just the product of other more material things. So that what's really going on there is debates about power or economics, or if someone's poor and doesn't have much opportunity in life, they're going to fall back on the crutches of religion. So this inability to take religion seriously as an explanatory variable. And that's a big part of what I want to challenge too. And I think that part of that has to do with, you know, me myself, I'm born and raised in the U.S., so I am a product, whether I like it or not, of a secularized culture, especially growing up in the kind of bastions of Northeastern liberalism, right? So I think that for people who come from that background, they have trouble seeing or understanding the everyday role of religion. But it goes beyond that. It's the everyday magic of religion for people who are true believers. And it's so natural, and it imbues everyday life with a kind of meaning and resonance in the Middle East. And it's something you see and you feel it. And I think it's sometimes really hard to grasp if you haven't experienced it yourself directly.
In the book, you talk about the kind of development of political Islam with the Muslim Brotherhood founded in 1928. And in your account, you describe how really modernity and Islamism are inseparable, and that political Islam was an attempt to adapt the modern state to Islam and vice versa, and that actually political Islam was a response or a reaction to modernity and secularism. And I think a lot of the narrative now, this isn't quite so clear. You know, people immediately think Islamists just want to move backwards to a kind of idealized past. But in many ways, in its modern form, throughout the 20th century and today, it's a very self-consciously modern phenomenon attempting to adapt the modern state to within a religious Islamic framework. Could you just kind of tease open this a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think this notion that Islamists inevitably want to go back, that they kind of hold, they want to copy and paste the 7th century onto the modern world. That to me, you know, it's nonsense. It's totally wrong. And Islamists, at least mainstream Islamists, so I should be specific about that. I'm not talking here about ISIS. I'm talking about Muslim Brotherhood and Brotherhood-inspired movements. And these are movements that are inherently modernist. They actually, in some ways, don't look back as much as they look forward in ways that ultra-conservatives even are uncomfortable with. So you said that, you mentioned that Islamism is a reaction to modernity. I would go further and say mainstream Islamism is a product of modernity. And part of what's going on here, and if I had to sum up mainstream Islamism in a sentence, I would say it's the attempt to reconcile pre-modern Islamic law with the modern nation state. So essentially the idea here is to take something which was designed for the pre-modern era, because of course the Quran was revealed in 7th century Arabia. So naturally it's not designed for the demands of the modern era, so it has to in some way be reimagined or reinterpreted. And this is precisely what groups like the Muslim Brotherhood have been trying to do is to, let's say, make Islamic law safe for the modern state, or maybe it's the other way around, to make the modern nation state safe for Islam. And I think that that's part of why Islamism is inherently contradictory. It's really hard to reconcile these dueling elements. The nation state has a logic of its own, and it's a very powerful logic. And this is where I think I also want to challenge this idea that Islamists, all Islamists are against the nation state. Sometimes it's actually quite the opposite, that some Islamists have fallen in love with the nation state. They've become obsessed with it, even if they themselves don't always realize it. And I think that's one reason why groups like the Brotherhood or its descendants or affiliates, or including, I would argue, and we can get to this later, the AK Party in Turkey, have fallen into some problems because they can't think beyond this state. Or to put it differently, they've lost the ability to think beyond the state. They don't know how anymore. And I think that's something that Islamist parties really have to reckon with if they want to get beyond the impasse that they currently find themselves in.
What about the danger that seeing Islam as exceptional could run the risk of taking a kind of essentialist position, sort of assuming that Islam is inherently different and can't change, and that political Islam by extension is the only authentic version of Islam? I mean, all Muslim majority countries have this tension between secular and non-secular Muslims, and it might be wrong to assume that conservatism is this hallmark of Muslim authenticity. I mean, there are many Muslims who have argued for a more liberal version of Islam, or for who religion is not a public matter at all, and these shouldn't somehow be seen as inauthentic positions. Do you think there's a risk in presenting political Islam as the only, quote, legitimate political force, which inherently delegitimizes all opposition?
Sure. So first of all, when we use the word inherently, so if we're saying that Islam is inherently different, what does that word inherently really mean? So I would say that Islam is a product of its own history. So for the believer would say that Islam had to be revealed in a certain way, and it was inevitable because it was God's will, right? But if you're coming at it from an academic perspective, you might say, well, of course the Quran has something to say about law and governance, because Prophet Muhammad was a state builder. And if he was capturing new territory and holding it, then he had to contend with questions of how to govern that territory. So the Quran had to say something to inform that experience. And if Prophet Muhammad hadn't been the head of this incipient state in Medina, then perhaps in a kind of counterfactual parallel history, the Quran wouldn't have had to address questions of governance the way that it did. So that to me is not inherent. That is a product of what actually happened at that particular time. And this is a main point of divergence with Christianity, where Jesus was not in a position to govern. He was a dissident against the reigning state. So it's no mistake then that the New Testament has very little to say about matters of law and governance. And in those crucial early centuries of Christianity, Christians were a minority living under other people's rule. So it wasn't until several centuries into the Christian experience when Christians finally had to contend with these issues. And those early years are critical. So that to me is not an argument about, that's not an essentialist argument, at least as I understand it. That's an argument that history matters and the founding moments of religions matter as well. On this question of am I sort of saying that Islamism is the only legitimate approach because first of all, you don't need to be an Islamist to believe that Islam should play a central role in public life. You can have Islamism You can have Islamism without Islamists, which may sound counterintuitive, but we actually see this in many parts of the Muslim world. So, for example, if we look at Malaysia and Indonesia, it's actually been ostensibly secular parties which have experimented with Sharia ordinances on the local level. Why? Because if they want to win in conservative regions, they have to be able to appeal to this conservative sentiment where ordinary voters want more Islam in their politics, not less. We see something similar. So the most anti-Islamist leader today is probably the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. But Sisi is no secularist. He has said very openly and very explicitly that it is the role of the president to promote the correct understanding of Islam for Egyptians. So he has a vision of a kind of state Islam, an Egyptian Islam. He has also launched campaigns, or his regime has launched campaigns against gays, Shias, Baha'is, secular dissidents, those who use profanity and who blaspheme in novels or contradict the moral compass of Egyptians. We see a lot of that happening under Sisi. That doesn't mean he's an Islamist. It means he's reflecting a kind of conservative consensus that exists in Egyptian society. And I wouldn't want to also give the impression that if Islam is somehow exceptional, that means that Islam is a very narrow tradition. In fact, Islam is a rich tradition with so many different expressions and approaches, and whether it's you have from Sufis, Islamists, Salafis, Wahhabis, liberals, progressives, you name it, you have that. But the argument I would make is that if you are a secular Muslim and you're arguing for the separation of religion from politics, you are probably going to have a lot of trouble selling your case, because you essentially have to argue against the prophetic model. And as I mentioned, Prophet Muhammad was a head of state. So he wasn't only a prophet, cleric, or theologian. He was also someone who governed. So the political and religious functions were intertwined together in the person of Prophet Muhammad. So if you want to say that Muslims should separate those two things, then you have to contend with the prophetic model. And how do you do that? It's not easy. And that's why secular Muslims have failed to really gain traction. Their ideas have failed to gain traction in much of the Muslim world.
And I think you referenced there this dichotomy between the secular state and the religious society, which obviously has salience in Turkey, because Turkey is obviously seen as this classic model of the secular state in the Middle East. But on closer inspection, things sometimes look a bit more ambiguous here, because in a way, I sometimes think of Republican history in Turkey as being basically this story of religious sentiments just seeping into the system, basically from its founding in 1923. It just steadily happens over the decades. And particularly since the 1980 coup, there's been this strong emphasis on the so-called Turkish Islamic synthesis as a pillar of state identity, which was basically this kind of Islamic nationalist coalition. Yeah. At the heart of the state, which was presenting this kind of conservative agenda in the name of stability. So in a way, this kind of rigid dichotomy between the secular state and the religious society, which is, it's propagated both by its supporters and its Islamist opponents. Actually, it's a bit more ambiguous on closer inspection. And I suspect the same is the case in other countries as well. You mentioned Sisi there. There are other examples. I think about, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the classic secular Baathist in quotation mark. But throughout the 1990s, he was promoting very religious, emphasizing Sunni identity. And so in a way, this kind of rigid dichotomy between the secular state and religious society isn't quite so clear cut.
Exactly. And this is why everyone uses religion. It's just a question of how they use it and to what ends. So you take the most secular leaders, and they had to talk about religion in their own way. They had to find a way to incorporate that into state discourse and state policy, because again, we're dealing with relatively conservative societies, and you can have the an autocratic leader who doesn't really care about the voting public because no one votes, but he still has to be at least somewhat responsive to that popular sentiment. And that in this sense, Islam is such a natural means of discourse. It's such a natural currency of politics that it's almost effortless, right? And I think this is where, and that's not just today. That's the way it's been for the better part of 14 centuries. I mean, if we go back to the pre-modern era, Islam as an overarching religious and legal culture informed everything. It went without saying, so it wasn't said, right? What I think is different about the modern era is that Islam is being challenged for the first time because of the rise of secularism and colonialism. So you have this situation where people have to affirm their religious identity. They have to assert it. They have to go on and on and say, I'm Islamic or I'm authentic. And then everyone competes with everyone else about who is the guardian of true Islamic identity. And that's another reason why Islamism could not have existed in any era but our own. Islamism would have made no sense if we were talking 4 centuries ago, because again, why would you have to call yourself an Islamist if Islam was already imbuing every facet of every facet of public life and politics, right? So I think that there is ambiguity here, and the fact that even so-called secular leaders have had to find ways to speak the language of religion, I think, is instructive for us. And Turkey, and that's why Turkey for me is just a fascinating laboratory. And, you know, that's why when people talk about Turkey, they can talk about it endlessly, because there's just so much there to kind of mine historically. And I think Turkey is also, in some ways, it supports one of the bigger points that I'm trying to make, is that even when you have vigorous efforts to control the role of Islam or to minimize its power in politics, that those efforts are really doomed to fail in the long run. So here you have Ataturk promoting a kind of state Islam, and the state is trying to control Islam for its own purposes, and to have a secularizing project. So Islam still mattered, but the idea was that it would matter less, and that there would be this overarching Turkish nationalism which would supersede everything else. But despite those efforts, and despite generations of Turks growing up with this kind of this ethos, this ideology, this indoctrination, Turkey has seen a resurgence of religion in public life and politics. And the example of that is the AK Party and its predecessors, which were able to gain more and more ground in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So the lesson there is you can try, but if people have the choice to vote in free and fair elections, eventually they're going to say that they want at least somewhat more Islam in their politics, not less.
Now, you mentioned Turkey. You were here, I think, a month ago, and you had meetings with senior government officials and others. I mean, what did you notice had changed in the atmosphere, if anything, from your previous visits?
So the atmosphere was definitely more tense, and there was a sense that things weren't right. And you know, a couple of days after I left Turkey, we have the whole kind of Erdogan-Davutoğlu split kind of coming to the fore, and Davutoğlu having to resign and all of that. So so I was there at a very interesting time. But I think that, you know, part of what's fascinated me about talking to people in the AK Party, whether former or current officials and so on, is the polarization is so much more in your face. And this became very clear to me in my research trip to Turkey last year. And some of those interviews are featured in the book, where I met, for example, with senior advisors to Prime Minister Davutoğlu and President Erdogan and so on. And this isn't the case for all AK Party officials, but definitely some of them. They made no pretense of national dialogue or trying to reach out to secularists. Some of them were essentially saying, this is our moment. And we kind of hate secularists, and we're not going to apologize for it. We want to destroy them. We want to relegate them to the dustbins of history. And I'm not used to that, because as someone who's worked more on Islamist movements in Egypt, Jordan, and Tunisia, I've always been used to Islamists at least offering the pretense of caring about the feelings of secularists. They may not be sincere, they may deep down hate secularists, but they feel a need to at least pretend, right? And what was really, you know, interesting and in some ways even refreshing about Turkey is that people don't play around. If they hate their political opponent, they will tell you they hate their political opponent. So that's interesting. It's also scary, because it shows that the center has weakened. And if you try to do a little test and you try to come up with the names of centrist journalists who are balanced and objective and are somewhere in the middle, you don't find many of them anymore, because everyone's forced to take sides. You're either with us or against us. And I think that is the most dangerous aspect today of Turkish politics, that it's always had a combative tone. And that's, in a way, part of Turkish political culture, this kind of roughness when it comes to political elites and their maneuvering against each other. But it seems to have gotten worse, not better. And you would have hoped that with decades of democratic experience, the center would have grown stronger, but that hasn't been the case.
It strikes me in Turkey, it's easy to forget that it's a kind of modern phenomenon, in the sense that political Islamist parties only sort of first started emerging in the 1970s and 1980s. And before then, there were, you know, fairly traditional sort of center-right politicians. And I just wonder, I mean, this kind of shows that the flux of history sort of changes the narrative, changes the parameters of debate. So it's not like there's this political Islam that is this timeless force that's always been there and it's always going to be there. It does wax and wane with the tides of modern history, I suppose.
Well, exactly. And that's why I would say that the argument of my book isn't that political Islam is timeless. It's more that Islam as a religion, as a faith tradition, is timeless, in the sense that it is going to matter in people's lives in ways that Westerners may not be comfortable with. You know, and of course we have to problematize the very notion of Islam. And again, I don't want to give the impression that Islam is something that can be clearly defined. But Islam, in all of its richness and diversity, is a very powerful thing in people's lives. And that's something that I myself have come to appreciate over time. The more time I've spent in the Middle East and conducted research, you see all the different ways that it motivates people. In this very, it drives people, it animates them, it gives them hope, it makes them do things they otherwise wouldn't do.
Yeah, and I also want to address the region, because obviously the wider region that Turkey finds itself in is in this state of severe meltdown or flux at the moment. And I just want to talk about the paths forward, because obviously a lot of Islamist movement, I mean, it's different in Turkey where they're in power still, but a lot of Islamist movements, and I'm thinking of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere, have basically been on the run and ruthlessly crushed by repressive regimes. But you've emphasized in a lot of articles that these are mass movements with very deep roots, and it's essentially impossible to stamp them out. So with that in mind, I mean, how do you see the future? And also with particular reference to the new challenge of the rising allure of jihadism with ISIS, etc.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I think, first of all, I think it's really important for us as analysts to separate between our personal preferences and what's realistically possible in the Middle East. So I myself, as an American, may be liberal and think that a more secular order is preferable and so on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I can or should try to superimpose those ideas on other societies. And that really has to be up to the people who live in those societies. So that's why this idea, so maybe in theory, it would be better if the Middle East becomes more liberal and secular and whatever. But part of my argument is that even if it was preferable, it's very unlikely. There's very little evidence there to suggest that this process that many in the West would like to see is going to come to pass. So we just have to be realistic, and that's where I think the implications are important, that there has to be a coming to terms with Islam's outsized role in public life, whether we like it or not. No one said we have to like it or agree with it or respect it, but we have to come to terms with it as the reality on the ground. And I think that we also have to be careful what we wish for, too, that, you know, oh, it's good. We might think to ourselves, okay, it's good that Islamist parties, mainstream Islamist parties like the Muslim Brotherhood, have been defeated and pushed out of power and all of that. But that has also strengthened the narrative of jihadist groups like ISIS, which say, look, this mainstream gradual approach was tried and it failed. And peaceful protest and elections and the democratic process, they're all nice in theory, but they don't actually work. So ISIS's message is that violence is effective. Violence is the only way to get anything done in the Middle East. So we as outside observers or analysts or policymakers, whatever, I think we have to think seriously about the incentive structures that are currently in place in the region, that people have more and more incentives to turn to violence. That doesn't mean that they're going to join ISIS, but it means that in many of the countries we're looking at now, whether it's Libya, Yemen, Syria, and so on, the temptation to turn to violence has become more and more tempting over time because that's become the currency of politics. And it's not just rebel groups in opposition, but also these resurgent authoritarian regimes who have learned that if you don't care about shedding blood in the streets and killing your own citizens, you can actually find a way to stay in power. That's the really sad takeaway from the past 5 years. That instead of looking to President Mubarak in Egypt and Ben Ali in Tunisia and saying, oh, look, they should have embarked on reforms earlier. No, leaders today are saying they were softies. They gave up on power too easily and too quickly, and they should have held on for dear life, even if that meant more and more bloodshed. But my hope is that people in the region will find ways to address those contradictions through peaceful political processes. So I'm not going to be one of these optimists and say, oh, if you get people together and have them talk to each other, they're gonna understand the other better or change their views. I don't really buy that. I think people will continue to have fundamentally different visions for the future of their countries. But they can have those very different visions as long as they agree together to express them peacefully. I think that's really the most we can hope for.
That was Shadi Hamid talking about his new book, Islamic Exceptionalism: How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. You can find a link to my review of the book via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, and there's also an edited transcript of this interview on there. Don't forget you can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you like the podcast, please do rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can like the Facebook page. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can support the podcast via my Patreon account on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Bey Arslan and Steve Bryant. Find links to all that on all the Turkey Book Talk pages. And in the meantime, until next time, thank you very much for listening.